Sitting on the dais with him that morning was Robert G. Sproul, president of the University of California, Berkeley. Stunned by Oppenheimer's stark language, Sproul was further unsettled by the private words they exchanged between speeches. Sproul had come with the intention of winning Oppenheimer back to Berkeley. He knew Oppie was disaffected. On September 29th, the physicist had written him to say that he was undecided about his future. Several other institutions had offered him tenured faculty positions with salaries ranging from 2 to 3 times what he was paid at Berkeley. And despite his long years in Berkeley, Oppie said he was aware of a certain lack of confidence on the part of the university for what it must inevitably have regarded as my indiscretions of the past. By indiscretions, Oppenheimer was referring to Sproul's annoyance with his political activities on behalf of the teachers' union. It would be wrong, he wrote Sproul, to return to Berkeley if the university and the physics department didn't really want him. And it would seem wrong to me to return at a salary so out of proportion to those of other institutions. Sproul, a rigid and conservative man, had always thought Oppenheimer troublesome, so he had hesitated when Ernest Lawrence proposed that they offer to double Oppie's salary. Lawrence argued that how much we pay Professor Oppenheimer really means nothing because the government will place such large sums at our disposal if Oppenheimer is here that his salary will be insignificant. Reluctantly, Sproul acquiesced. But now, as the two men sat on the dais and discussed the matter, Oppenheimer brushed aside Sproul's offer, repeating in substance what he had said in his letter. He was aware that his colleagues in the physics department and Sproul himself were not enthusiastic about having him return because of his difficult temperament and poor judgment. He then abruptly informed Sproul that he had decided to teach at Caltech, but even so, he asked Sproul for a formal extension of his leave of absence, thus leaving the door open to a return to Berkeley at a later date. Though understandably miffed by the tenor of this conversation, Sproul felt compelled to agree to Oppie's request. Oppenheimer's behavior suggests he was unsure about his next step, but certain that it had to be a significant one. Part of him wanted to recreate the good years he had lived in Berkeley. And yet, increasingly comfortable with his post-war stature, he was also drawn by new ambitions. He temporarily resolved this conundrum by rejecting the offers from Harvard and Columbia in favor of Caltech's. He could remain in California while keeping open the option to return to Berkeley. In the meantime, he would spend many exhausting days shuttling aboard propeller-driven airplanes back and forth to Washington, D.C. Indeed, on October 18th, just a day after the award ceremony in Los Alamos, Oppenheimer was back in Washington for a conference at the Statler Hotel. In the presence of a half-dozen senators, Oppenheimer outlined in stark terms the perils to the country posed by the atomic bomb. Also in attendance was Henry A. Wallace, vice president during Roosevelt's third term, 1941 to 1945, now serving as Truman's Commerce Secretary. Seizing the occasion, Oppenheimer walked up to Wallace and said he very much wanted to talk with him privately. Wallace invited him to take a walk the following morning. Walking with the former vice president through downtown Washington toward the Commerce Department, Oppie revealed his deepest anxieties about the bomb. He rapidly outlined the dangers inherent in the administration's policies. Afterwards, Wallace wrote in his diary that, "I never saw a man in such an extremely nervous state as Oppenheimer. He seemed to feel that the destruction of the entire human race was imminent." Oppie complained bitterly that the Secretary of State Burns felt that we could use the bomb as a pistol to get what we wanted in international diplomacy. Oppenheimer insisted that this would not work. He says the Russians are a proud people and have good physicists and abundant resources. They may have to lower their standard of living to do it, but they will put everything they have got into getting plenty of atomic bombs as soon as possible. He thinks the mishandling of the situation at Potsdam has prepared the way for the eventual slaughter of tens of millions or perhaps hundreds of millions of innocent people. Oppenheimer admitted to Wallace that even the previous spring, well before the Trinity test, many of his scientists were enormously concerned about a possible war with Russia. He had thought that the Roosevelt administration had worked out a plan to communicate with the Soviets about the bomb. This hadn't happened, he suspected, because the British had objected. Still, he thought Stimson had a very statesmanlike view of the whole matter, and he referred approvingly to the Secretary of War's September 11th memo to President Truman, which, he said, had advocated turning over to Russia the industrial know-how as well as the scientific information. At this point, Wallace interrupted to say that Stimson's views on this point had never even been introduced at a cabinet meeting. Obviously disturbed to hear this news, Oppenheimer said that his scientists back in New Mexico were completely disheartened. All they think about now are the social and economic implications of the bomb. At one point, Oppie asked Wallace if he thought it would do any good for him to see the president. Wallace encouraged him to try to get an appointment through the new Secretary of War, Robert P. Patterson. On this note, the two men parted. Wallace subsequently noted in his diary, "The guilt consciousness of the atomic bomb scientists is one of the most astounding things I have ever seen."